Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Segment one this morning, another in my occasional series, what's it really like to be well, we've done everything from psychiatrist to prostitute. This morning, what's it really like to be a lexicographer? That's a person who helps create dictionaries. It may sound boring. After all, controversial lexicography would seem to be an oxymoron. Indeed, I've always considered the dictionary to be one of Prince's few safe spaces. But in doing the research for the show, I was surprised to learn that lexicographers are now being accused of bias. For example, the left combed the Oxford Dictionary's 171,476 words to find three or four examples that they viewed as anti-female. For example, a sentence used to explain one meaning of the word rabid used the term rabid feminist. Left didn't like that. The right complained about that same in Oxford Dictionary, which is, by the way, what Google uses to provide definitions when people search on a term and they want the definition, that they use the Oxford Dictionary. Well, the right complained that the Oxford Dictionary slash Google did the following. A few months before the most recent presidential election, a major conservative publication called the Daily Caller complained that Google and in turn the Oxford Dictionary, uses the word right-wing in its definition of fascism, while the equally august Merriam-Webster Dictionary does not. And even today, when you Google search on the terms fascism or fascist, after the definition sites, the next six results are for Donald Trump. Samuel Johnson called lexicographers, quote, harmless drudges. Well, clearly things have changed at least a bit since the 18th century. And I have found an eminent lexicographer to be on the show this morning who is no drudge. So let me introduce Ben Zimmer. He is the language columnist for the Wall Street Journal and former columnist for the New York Times Magazine. He was executive editor at vocabulary.com, a great site, by the way, for improving your vocabulary. A very, very good system for giving feedback and upgrading. It's like it branches. The harder the word you get right, the harder the next word will be, and the easier. So it branches. It's really quite efficient. Very good system. Smart. He's also an editor for American Dictionaries at Oxford University Press and consultant to the gold standard Oxford, I think Oxford English Dictionary, maybe the Oxford American, I don't remember. He has been interviewed widely, including on CNN, The Today Show, and NPR's Morning Edition. And now, Ben Zimmer, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Hi, thanks for having me.
My pleasure indeed. Well, to give us a window into what it's really like to be a lexicographer, let's at least start by looking at some of those controversial challenges that a lexicographer today might be facing amid the culture wars. So let's start with the one of those four words in the Oxford Dictionary that some feminists have protested is the word shrill. They complain that it's being applied to more often to women in that dictionary. But shrill does refer to, and I think the ungendered definition is that shrill refers to an annoying high pitch, and women do unarguably have higher pitched voices. So there we have a dilemma. If you were the lexicographer dealing with that, what would you do?
Well, these are tricky situations for lexicographers to handle. And, dictionary makers, lexicographers, see their work as descriptive. We're describing the language as it is, as it's actually used, not how it should be used in some perfect world or some idealized view of the language. So that sometimes means that there are words whose usage will reflect our stereotypes, and sometimes those stereotypes may have to do with gender. In a word like shrill, as you say, that word that's used for high-pitched or piercing voices or sounds, it is very often, if you look at the evidence, applied to women's voices. And you can see that it's very often a way to negatively characterize a woman's voice. So what is the dictionary maker to do? You can define it as, you know, high-pitched and piercing. You can give examples of it as well. We talk about a shrill laugh and that sort of thing. But the question is, how much do you sort of recreate the kind of gender stereotypes people have, in this case, with women's voices? If there are stereotypes about women's voices that they are annoying somehow, should the examples that a dictionary gives, in addition to the definition, include that? And so it's a tricky kind of balancing act because, again, you don't want to simply just, you know, sometimes reproduce these stereotypes. At the same time, it is necessary to draw on actual usage, the way people actually use these words. And sometimes, you know, these things will come out and people will notice them very often. And you mentioned examples of shrill and rabid. These are words that people have looked at recently and asked the dictionary makers, well, why are you using these examples that are specifically about women?
Of course, the women, the shrill thing is because women's, at least voices, there's no question physiologically their voices are higher pitched. But let's be fair to both genders here. One definition of the word jerk is an obnoxious person. And in actual usage, the word jerk is mainly used to describe men, despite men not having a monopoly on obnoxious behavior. And that would seem to put the lexicographer in a similar kind of no-win situation. You know, the job as a lexicographer is to present as much information that is accurately circumscribing that word as possible. But if the entry that states jerk as mainly applying to men, that's sexist against men. But if the entry doesn't state that, it inadequately defines jerk's usage, right?
That's true. And we
have
tools that can sort of check our hunches. We don't have to simply rely on, you know, our general feeling about the language. What lexicographers do now is they consult what's called a corpus, which is a big collection of texts that can number in the billions of words because we have so many texts at our disposal online these days, and do an analysis and really see, well, how are people using a word like jerk? Is it mostly for men? Because we can actually analyze that now. And you may just find out, yes, jerk may be overwhelmingly describing men more than women, in which case I think it is the lexicographer's duty to put that in. You know, again, it may be displaying another type of gender stereotype, but it's incumbent on the lexicographer to say, well, if it's being used mostly for men, then indicate that in the entry. So it's, as I said, a difficult balancing act because you don't want to simply say, you know, very jejune gender stereotypes, women are like this and men are like that. And yet that's often the way, especially with disparaging terms, they get assigned to certain kinds of people that may break down on gender or race or other factors. And if it's disparaging, that's another thing the dictionary has to indicate and say, this is pejorative, this is something that's used to put people down. And that kind of usage label is also really key so people understand how these words are working in the world.
Doesn't that inhibit kind of the living language thing and could potentially reinforce extant stereotypes? Let's take African Americans. There are certain denigrating terms that have disproportionately been used to describe African Americans, and I'm not going to even mention them for risk of engendering controversy, but there certainly are some. And so if the lexicographer simply uses a corpus to look at word frequencies and says, okay, well, more African Americans are more likely than other groups to be used, be called that denigrating term, doesn't that reinforce stereotypes and therefore shouldn't, you know, there should not be a double standard? If, you know, yes, men may more often be called jerks, but if there's no evidence per se that men are more often have a monopoly on jerk behavior, doesn't this really create, isn't this where the, am I correct? We're trying to get into what it's really like to be a lexicographer. Does this not get into the essence of the kind of debates that lexicographers, one type of the debate that lexicographers have?
It does, it does. And these are the questions that lexicographers may be wrestling with all the time, especially over these hot button words, so disparaging terms. And sometimes they become the center of lawsuits and court cases.
Right.
We look at, you know, the Washington Redskins and all of the debate over the term redskin and how dictionaries have handled that. That's actually entered the courts. So sometimes this can really blow up into something that's highly charged, and dictionary makers always are trying to be as conscientious as possible to, again, describe the language as it is, as it's actually being used, not shy away from difficult or controversial words, but treat them accurately, the way people are using them, and if necessary, applying usage labels so that readers will really know if a particular word is pejorative, again, based on how it's used in the real world. And if that reproduces some, you know, nasty stereotypes, that has to be reflected on some level, but at the same time, that there's no need to sort of add on to that by you know, only having, say, you know, examples about women's voices for shrill. There may be other things that may be useful for exemplifying that word. So, you know, again, these are issues that that are not easy to resolve, and it sometimes puts lexicographers in a no-win situation. There are cases where both sides in a political argument may be attacking dictionary makers for not defining the words that they want the way they want them to. And so it can be a real challenge sometimes.
I'm sure that in a previous era, when even far later than Samuel Johnson's time, and probably in a future era, our conversation about lexicography would not focus so much on race, class, gender, the usual things, but we are in an era where the zeitgeist is almost defined, certainly disproportionately, by looking through everything at the lenses of race, class, and gender. And so since this is 2017, I'm focusing on that because I think that's where some of the meaty, feisty issues, you know, is. There's no argument necessarily about the word, you know, be or to or whatever. And yet even pronouns are not immune to activist pressures. For example, there are some academics that are pushing for replacing the word he or she, he and she, with a gender-neutral term like zay, or whatever, I'm not quite sure how it's pronounced, even though that conveys less information. It leaves out the gender of the subject, of the person you're talking with. So regarding that issue, that little pronoun, are lexicographers debating or discussing that issue?
Definitely. And in the case of pronouns, you rightly say that those basic words might not seem so controversial, but we find that pronouns are actually rather controversial these days as people sort of wrestle with the idea of, can we, in English, have a singular third-person pronoun that does not refer to gender. Even if it doesn't convey as much information as a gendered pronoun, there are many cases where one would want that type of pronoun, mm-hmm. where perhaps the gender is not necessary to identify, if we're just talking about a person in general, and we don't want to say he or she because that's a bit wordy. Why can't we just say they or their or them and use that with a singular referent? And you mentioned there were various other pronouns that have been suggested. You know, many have been suggested over the years to fill this slot that English lacks. But singular they is the most common, most popular one, because it's really been in the language, actually used as a singular pronoun for centuries, and many of the greatest writers, from Chaucer to Shakespeare to Jane Austen, have actually used it in this singular fashion.
Problem with
nowadays, it becomes more of an issue of identity politics as people look for pronouns that may move beyond the gender binary, so that there, you know, many people sort of crafting identities beyond the binary of he or she.
I'll leave it at that. I want to be, again, fair. These objections so far that we've been focusing on have mainly been from the left. Let me do one from the right. The right has complained, and then we're going to leave this race, class, gender thing for now. The right has complained about Google's, and again, the Oxford Dictionary is the basis of Google definitions when you search on Google for a definition. Anyway, the definition that you find from when you use Google or the Oxford Dictionary, it includes an example sentence for the word trap, And here's the quote that the right objects to. Police deliberately herded 400 demonstrators into a trap and then attacked and arrested them. That's a quote as an example. Now, I would, you know, the right was not exactly thrilled with defining trap in that highly politicized term. If you were the lexicographer asked to deal with that, how might you approach it?
Well, for a word like trap, there's really no need to have an example sentence that is going to get people riled up one way or the other, depending on their political stance. So, you know, that was an example sentence, again, that was found, a real-world sentence that Oxford used as an example, and because Google licenses that dictionary content, it was showing up in Google results for the word trap.
Exactly.
You know, I just looked on the, you know, Oxford Dictionary that supplied that, and I don't even see that sentence anymore. So it may have just been silently removed. And this is, again, lexicographers are able to do these things with online dictionaries these days and say, you know what, we don't want this trouble over a word like trap, which isn't even a political word to begin with. There's no point in sort of, like, you know, riling people up simply based on an example sentence that's given when there are thousands and thousands of other possible sentences one could use to exemplify that. So, you know, I would say, yeah, there's no need to, use a sentence like that, which could be perceived as, you know, as somehow, you know, part of a liberal agenda, which is, you know, very often on these sites on the right, they're looking for examples of, oh, here is Google trying to promote a liberal agenda. That's all kind of really secondary to what lexicographers are trying to do. And so with online dictionaries, you can simply say, well, you know what? Fine. We don't need that sentence. We'll give you 100 other ones that have nothing to do with politics.
Yeah. These days, everything is political. I remember coming up to someone and saying something about, asking her, complimenting about her hair. I really didn't like it, but it's very close cropped. But I, you know, when you see somebody edgy, you know, they probably were, you know, welcome a little bit of, you know, affirmation of that. So I said, and she got offended. I said, this is political. Everything is political. Even your haircut is political. So we live in a very, especially here in the Bay Area, we are in a very, very politically sensitive era. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. My guest is Ben Zimmer. We're talking about what it's really like to be a lexicographer and talking about kind of the today's cutting edge, especially here in the Bay Area, for all use of language, of which lexicographers are, the, in some sense, the arbiter or an arbiter of it. I'm talking with Ben Zimmer, who is a language columnist for The Wall Street Journal and former columnist for The New York Times Magazine. He was executive editor for Vocabulary.com, been involved in the American Dictionaries for Oxford University Press, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I'd like to invite you to call in. If you have a question or a comment about what it's really like to be a lexicographer, and it doesn't need to focus on race, class, and gender, the phone number here, Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. I can't resist one more. You know, and this is an objection from the left that I'm going to raise. America is becoming ever more diverse and has subcultures that use words different from standard English. Do such words make it into dictionary revisions, and how do they get identified and the research conducted on what of these regionalisms or subcultural terms get put into the entry in the dictionary?
They should absolutely enter any dictionary that purports to be comprehensive, a comprehensive description of the way the English language is used. No dictionary should focus strictly on so-called standard English. There are, you know, lots of, as you say, non-standard forms that may break down according to region or subculture and so forth. Those, again, can be marked with labels so that, you know, it's clearly marked, you know, here's a word that's used primarily in, let's say, Latino English, just to pick a, you know, just to pick an example, or, you know, or anything else like that, which may not be considered standard. You know, there are slang terms, there are colloquial terms, there's a whole sort of gamut of usage out there in the real world which lexicographers want to describe, and this has been the mission of dictionaries all along. You know, you can look in older dictionaries too and find many of these terms that are not necessarily standard. They could, again, be colloquial slang and so forth. And that's fine. You know, it can enter a dictionary, can be given a particular label so people know, you know, this isn't standard. It's associated perhaps with a particular group or region. And that's okay. It's all part of describing the living language and how it works.
It's unarguable when you're talking about an unabridged dictionary or these days an online dictionary, we can include everything. But we still have many people, certainly in the schools and in the colleges, the Merriam-Webster Collegiate Dictionary still sells a zillion copies. There are student dictionaries of a variety of stripes. And so that's where it becomes an interesting issue. There are certainly, for example, in urban schools, there are certain linguistic form words and phrases that are germane specifically to a non-standard English group, to African Americans, to Latinos, to etc. And to what extent do they deserve full representation in, say, a dictionary that has only 50,000 words, like a collegiate dictionary might have, as opposed to a 400,000 word, 200,000 word Oxford dictionary.
That's a good point, that smaller dictionaries do have to make these choices. They can't sort of describe everything that's out there. But if there are certain things, again, that are non-standard but are very frequently used, then even the smaller dictionaries need to include those things. There are obviously, you know, a lot of decisions that have to be made about what to include and what not to include. Although these days, very often, we have online dictionaries which don't have those space requirements, and so that you can actually, include these things without having to worry about space considerations. But there are a lot of factors to weigh, and very often you're using a corpus, and hopefully, you know, that corpus reflects not just standard English, but various other types of language out there in order to make those decisions.
Yeah, for those of you just joining us, a corpus is a word frequency list. There are about 200,000 words in the English language, and there are these lists. One is, I know, put out by BYU, of all places, Brigham Young University, that has the approximate word frequency for all 200,000, and that can govern what words go into what dictionary. Kind of a related point, and again, I'm going to take this liberal side just because it just popped into my head. The use of standard English, even among liberal professors, is extolled in English classes, college English classes and the like. And there are many people who either don't take the time to learn, as a political statement, don't want to learn, or can't learn standard English at a high enough level. And that ends up being a barrier to their entry into a wide range of jobs, especially white-collar jobs and other professions. To what extent do you have an opinion, either as a lexicographer or as a human being, as to the relative importance of standard English? Because what it's argued that standard English has the English language is I love the English language because of its precision. It has so much nuance. You know, you can say near synonyms like cowardly, recreant, pusillanimous, and they're not quite synonyms. And the master of standard English knows those nuances and can really say precisely what he or she wants to say. What are your thoughts about the trade-off between lexicographers and the language focusing on precise word use and standard English grammar versus the exclusionary result of that to people who can't or don't want to learn so much standard English?
I don't think it ever has to be an either-or situation where there's standard English or, you know, non-standard varieties of English, and you have to make a choice. And many, many people in this country learn to be quite well-versed in different varieties of English. You can call people, you know, who know many dialects or registers of English. They know when it might be appropriate to use something non-standard and when to use something more standard. And our educational system rightly, shows when it's appropriate to use more standard language in more formal situations, as with, you know, essays for school or in job interviews and every other context like that. But I would also caution that I think that simply by valorizing standard English as somehow more precise or is a dangerous kind of ideology, I think that you can look at many different varieties of English, and there may be shades and nuances In each of them, African American English is a perfectly good example, where you know you can find you know the way that things like tense and aspect are used in African American English, just to use some linguistic terms, is different from what you would get in standard English. And that's interesting to see as like a formal system.
Great. Well,
so these are things that can be appreciated without in any way saying, well, you know, standard English isn't important. Of course, it's important in our society, but we can you know accept and study other varieties of English. And, you know, what they have that might be unique as
That's
well.
Really interesting. Can you give me one, because I am ignorant in this regard, can you give me one example of an African-American usage that adds more nuance than perhaps standard English?
Well, you know, so, you know, sometimes things in African-American English are seen as somehow a simplification of standard English, when that's often not the case. And so when, for instance, the form of the verb to be is used, and sometimes it's not inflected, as you know, we have different inflections of different forms of the word to be, such as is or are, and sometimes you can use in African American English an uninflected form of it, just be, you know, without doing that, so be doing or something like that. And that indicates a habitual action, which is something that, you know, may be difficult to capture, otherwise. And so, you know, that's just sort of one example where, you know, something that is often downplayed or seen as lesser or inferior somehow, actually, if you look carefully at it, may be conveying some nuances and some, you know, interesting way of expressing things, if you actually look at it carefully.
Let's move off with all that. And let's, you know, one of the things, again, we tend to think of dictionary makers as atavistic, as almost traditional, as hidebound. Again, those are lovely words. The English language is filled, you know, atavistic, hidebound. These are wonderful, I think, you know, wonderful words that I think maybe I'm just being, you know, fussy, but a fuss bucket. But I think they're wonderful. Anyway, but we tend to think of dictionaries and lexicographers that way, as a little bit retrospective. And yet, I was delighted to hear that dictionary makers are not just posting their dictionaries online, but they're even using social media in their work. Merriam-Webster, a leading dictionary maker, is using... How does Merriam-Webster use social media?
Well, that's been fascinating to see how dictionary publishers like Merriam-Webster have been embracing social media. And so, you know, one thing that lexicographers can do is when they have an online dictionary, they can see what are the words that people are looking up most often. And you can see, based on this lookup data, what the sort of the search queries that are coming into the dictionary, mm-hmm. that the words people are interested in, you know, sometimes it's just the old standbys, like affect versus effect. People mm-hmm. are always getting mm-hmm. confused about that. Mm-hmm. But very often, there are words in the news, words having to do with something happening in politics very often. So, this past week with the revelations about Donald Trump Jr.'s meeting with the Russian lawyer that was revealed by the emails that he released, people are looking up words like collusion and treason, quid
right.
pro quo.
Right.
So that kind of interesting information can actually, you know, you can sort of take a mirror and reflect it back and say, hey, these are the words people are interested in, and these are the sort of the trends, this is what we're watching. So Merriam-Webster has been very good at doing that. So very often these are words that people already know the meaning of but want to sort of get at those shades or nuances when it comes into prominence. So if Kellyanne Conway starts talking about alternative facts, as happened earlier this year, Merriam-Webster can say, well, people are interested in the mm-hmm. word fact, and here's mm-hmm. our definition of the word fact. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting, too, is that even just tweeting out a definition, as Merriam-Webster mm-hmm. did in that mm-hmm. case, can be seen as a political act. It's somehow mm-hmm. subversive mm-hmm. to say, well, mm-hmm. this is what the dictionary says is the definition of mm-hmm. fact. Dictionaries are just trying to provide a certain, you know, a certain standard or authority that we can use to figure out word meaning. But in this day and age, With everything being political, very often that can be seen itself as a political act, even just providing a dictionary definition.
Precisely. That is kind of the subtext, if there is a subtextual theme throughout this discussion, is that Samuel Johnson, his criticism that lexicographers are merely harmless drudges has changed in today's era. Let's take one phone call. Let's go to the phones and see what a listener has to say. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. My lexicographer guest, Ben Zimmer, what's your question or comment for him?
So I don't know why I like this topic so much, but like many college students, I used to read all the William Sapphire columns in the Sunday, I think it was called On Language, column
in the New York Times, yeah.
Yeah. So what I'm hearing is, any variation from standard English used can be acceptable or is defendable. So then if words can mean anything, how can you then say, oh, you can't define alternative facts that way, there is actually a word for fact? In other words, I'm hearing permissiveness and prescriptiveness, but no bright line.
Yeah. Well, this sounds like one of the macro, and I'm really interested in Ben's answer, but like it really defines, again, another core principle of the zeitgeist, which is, you know, absolutism versus cultural relativism. You know, one cannot say anymore that Beethoven is better than, for example, African drum beats. Are there discussions among lexicographers about that issue of absolutism versus cultural relativism, and there is less black and white than there was?
Well, these are fascinating issues to discuss, but I never think of these as simply either-or situations, mm-hmm. where you have to uphold, you know, only this thing that I'm calling standard English, or say everything is acceptable and there are no rules. It never works that way in real life, and dictionary makers don't think of things in those terms. It's possible to say, you know, here is the conventionally accepted meaning of a word. There could be other meanings that are sometimes considered incorrect, and dictionaries can actually say that. You know, they can tell you, well, you know, here's this word irregardless, for instance, and people use it sometimes, but a lot of people think that this word is simply wrong, mm-hmm. And may judge you for that.
Right.
And so that is also describing the real world and how people deal with language. Sometimes people make judgments about you based on the words that you use. Dictionary makers can point that out as well. And so it's possible, you know, very often we have this so-called descriptivist versus prescriptivist divide. But lexicographers very often are straddling that divide by, yes, describing how language is working, but also occasionally providing usage advice that will help people through this thicket and decide what is appropriate for what situation. So, you know, again, a lot of these, you know, variants that we might be talking about that are non-standard, they can be marked that way. And so people have a sense, oh, okay, well, this would be appropriate for some situations and not others.
Anyway, caller, thank you very much for the call. Well, I think you have given us a window. You know, I tried to straddle, to use your word, the fence between getting into enough of the weeds so that you really get a sense of the way in which some of the issues play out for lexicographers. I certainly appreciate, Ben Zimmer, your providing some insight into that. Is there anything you would like to point people to, some of your work or whatever, that or a website that you would like to encourage people to visit?
Well, you can follow me on Twitter at BG Zimmer, or on Facebook, Zimmer on Language, and I'm always posting the latest things I'm working on, my weekly column in the Wall Street Journal. My most recent one is on the phrase smoking gun, which we've been hearing a lot lately, where I dig into some of these word histories for the words and phrases that we're finding in the news these days.
Great, and that's on your website. Would that be at benzimmer.com?
That's correct.
Okay. Well, Ben, thank you very much for giving me part of your Sunday.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Good. Take care. Okay, and now, as usual, in segment two, we turn to you. We don't want to hear about lexicography or anything like that, but if you have a work problem of any sort, whether you're 16 or 76, whether it's a plebeian problem or an esoteric problem, an arcane problem, all of them are welcome here. All I care about is you've got a work-related problem, and I'll do my best to try to help. It's what I call a workover. This is the time to call when the lines are available. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemko and KALW, 415 841 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And very often people prefer, we're talking about specific careers and they're looking for career ideas. So I'll just offer a couple to kind of tick things off. I try to do that with some frequency. One of the other mega trends, not race, class, and gender, but certainly is we're going to, one way or another, nobody is talking, whether it be the right or the left, talking about insuring only some people. Everybody is going to be covered in one way or another, or certainly many more. And that means there is, and a lot of them are low-pay people who have also simultaneously have high needs. What's the lesson for that career-wise? That ever more of the medical services provided to you and me, to everybody, is going to be provided not by doctors or by radiologists or physical therapists, but what they call intermediate level providers. And most notably, that's physician assistant, but it also is going to mean physical therapy assistants. It's going to be radiologic assistants, anesthesia nurse anesthetists. I would encourage you, whether it's you or someone you know who's thinking about a career who wants to be in healthcare, think really hard about going into what are called these intermediate level careers. Yes, they're less prestigious, but they pay quite well. So that's one that I wanted to share with you. Another is school psychologist. This is a job that, because whenever something is federally mandated, it's not going away. And there is a whole panoply of both federal and state laws mandating special education services. I was originally a school psychologist, and back then the job was as much, whether it be parenting education or drug education or sex education, it had a broader function, or coaching gifted kids to survive in a mixed environment. But now, because the federal law focuses specifically on special education kids and their requirements, school psychologists are now mainly testers. And that can be boring because it's more fun to have a varied career, but it also ensures your employment. So your job is mainly screening kids for special ed services. You're going to observe the kid in the class. You're going to test them. You're going to maybe run a meeting of parents and teachers, regular ed teacher, special ed teacher, et cetera. And there are sometimes specialists, speech language pathologists and physical therapists, again, who might be working with special need kids, transportation people. There are some kids who need very special transportation to get there. And so the school psychologist often is the ringmaster who's, running the show in putting together these meetings. And so the school psychologist one. I mentioned briefly speech-language therapist. Indeed, I like to mention what's surprising. Most people think of speech-language therapists as working mainly in schools with kids, with a language delay or a speech impediment. But they also work in rehabilitation facilities. So, for example, if somebody has a stroke, very often they've lost some speech or even swallowing. And that's what speech and language therapists do, and with the aging population, there should be jobs. Masters is required, and especially, you need a fair amount of patients. Oh, one more medical career because it pops into my head. Surgical technologist. A lot of people want a healthcare career, but they don't want you have to go to college for 4 years or whatever. And maybe they like the adrenaline rush of the operating room. Well, there's a field called surgical technologist. It's about 2 years after you graduate from high school. And you're the person who sets up the operating room. You may be prepping the patients for surgery. And during an operation, you're probably the person who, when the surgeon yells, scalpel, retractor, whatever, you're the person who gives that to them. So surgical technologist, another of those under-the-radar careers that I like to tout because people, again, everybody thinks doctor, nurse, maybe physical therapist, but nobody thinks about being a surgical technologist or an imaging specialist. Or some kind of an electrocardiographic expert. So anyway, phone number again, if you have a work-related problem and you'd like my advice, I will try to help you. I call it a workover, whether you're young or old, self-employed, thinking about becoming self-employed, want to run your idea by me, I'll be kind of like a one-man shark tank. Price is certainly right. 0 Zippo 9 of the phone number here. Work with Marty Nemko for a workover. 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. I was looking before the show at I assemble my tweets. and pick the ones that I think are most useful to you. And I came across one that I particularly liked, and because it has there's an anecdote that comes to derives from it. And the tweet was, "It's fairly easy to be liked. Listen more than talk. Praise often, and disagree rarely. The question is it worth the loss of integrity?" Well, I want to bring that to life with an anecdote, a real-life anecdote that occurred last night. It was in my personal life, but I'll talk about in a minute how it applies to work. We had, as my wife and I, Barbara Nemco, like to do, we like to have a couple over for dinner. And we had a couple, lovely couple, great, really liked them a lot. And one of the topics that got discussed was the Israeli-Palestinian issue. And one of the people, one of the couple, was very I'm deliberately not going to say which side that person was, because I don't want to get, this is a show about work, it's not about the Israeli-Palestinian crisis. So one of the people was a very strong-minded supporter of one side of the Israeli-Palestinian issue. And my personal view was the opposite. And I had a choice. I was well aware that it would be nice and civil, we were having a perfectly lovely conversation about other things, for me to not say a thing, just nod and say, uh-huh, that's interesting. But there is and I would have been better liked, but there is a price. Are we always willing to pay the price? Are we willing to be less well-liked in exchange for saying your truth? And that applies immensely in the workplace. It doesn't have to be political. But how often in meetings, people are either too afraid to speak up, to say something contrary, especially, as they say, speak truth to power, especially reluctant to contradict or disagree with the boss, because they know that while everybody says we're open to contrary opinions, deep down, if only unconsciously, many of us are going to think less of a person or somehow seek retribution against that person for daring to disagree. So rather than the standard typical advice, which tends to be black and white, either, sure, disagree, you know, you need to speak your truth, speak truth to power, even in the workplace, you don't want to, or no, you know, you really got to watch yourself, you're going to get fired. You really need to ask yourself, how much is it worth your hiding your integrity, hiding your views in favor of being better liked? Anyway, now let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco.
Need help. Hang on.
Ah, well, I guess not. We'll go to the next line. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help? Hello, it's you. Are you there? Nope, we're 0 for 2. So I can give out the phone number again. If you were online and got to come out cut off or whatever happened, the mystical ignis fatuus. Now, there's a fancy word. Ignis fatuus literally means this murky, greenish fog that occurs over a bog. But it also can mean any attempt at some kind of mysterious, sometimes it's usually subterfuge, something you wouldn't use verbally, but ignis fatuus, I like that word. Like I do say, the English language is filled with nuance. Anyway, the phone number, if you want to work over any kind of work-related problem, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Let's try it again. Let's go back to the phones. It's your turn on the air. How can I help?
Hello?
Hi.
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 I'm kind of stuck in my career, and some different events led me to this place where I'm at, which is for a long time I was a nonprofit program manager, mm-hmm. Which I enjoyed a lot, and then I kind of got burnt out for different reasons, and I left that job, and then I had a kind of a long career search to get a new job, and I did finally get a new job doing an accounting kind of clerk,
wow.
kind of job.
Rather, did that really feel like a big come down from nonprofit program manager to accounting clerk?
Yeah, it was.
Right.
And it was kind of when the recession was going on, so it was partly related to that and stuff. But anyway, I've kind of gotten back on my feet in general, but I'd like to do something that is more fulfilling in a lot of ways. And so, but I'm finding that I have sort of a lack of confidence in finding a new job. I'm 51, so I'm kind of older, and I'm having a hard time figuring out how to get a job that's more, you know, fulfilling and pays more and all those things.
Okay, let's play here a little bit. I don't mean to play, I don't mean that dismissiveness, but I like a playful attitude towards doing this, but I'm it's deadly serious. So there are two kinds of lack of confidence. There are those that are illegitimate. In other words, if there was a goddess, the goddess would look down upon you and say, you really could, for example, go back and be a nonprofit program manager or something high level like that. Or the goddess could say, if the goddess is completely objective and fair, could say, you know, you rose to your level of incompetence. You really weren't that good. Maybe you got your job. You didn't really deserve it. You really belong as a clerk. I know you want more money, but you really need to accept yourself. What would the goddess say objectively, that you should aim higher, or would the goddess tell you to have self-acceptance as is?
Probably aim higher. I think I'm capable of doing a little more. Yeah.
A little more. So what would the goddess say is the kind of skill or two, one or two best abilities, knowledge-based skills that really are higher level that would justify your getting hired for a higher level position?
I am a good program manager. I can organize multiple tasks and projects at the same time, and I also have pretty good accounting skills to a degree. I don't have a degree in that, so it's kind of holding me back, I think. But so those two sets of areas are things that I'm good at.
So reading between the lines, I'm hearing you that you don't necessarily want to be a program manager, but if you were a program coordinator with some accounting responsibilities, but you were, you know, you cited your best program manager skills being organized. If I said you should look for coordinator jobs that incorporated both that organizational skill and your accounting skills, what feels right and wrong about that?
Okay, well, let me throw in a whole different thing, which is, I was thinking about, possibly doing, a master's program that I had my eye on, but I know that I've heard your, views on that, to a degree. Like, I understand that that's not necessarily the best choice all the time. But I guess what I'm trying to say is that I guess I would like to advance to a higher level than where I'm at. And I think program coordination might be a good step to do, but it's not necessarily where I'd want to stay.
Would the goddess say that the right next step would be to go and get the master's program worth the money and the time, not the years of not earned income, as the next step? Or would the goddess say that the coordinator is the next step? Coordinator job.
Yeah, I'm not sure on that. I don't know the answer.
Tell me
that.
About the master's program. What is the master's program? Because there was a long hesitation and a great nervousness in your voice when you brought up the master's program. Tell me about the master's program and the upside, the excitement, as well as your ambivalence about it.
Well, there's a program in nonprofit management, and then there's also a program in public policy. So they have a little different angles on things. I think when I think about it, I just wonder if I'll be hireable when I get out, like at a higher level than I'm at now. That's my big question, is will I be hireable?
Well, being coldly rational about it, This is, you know, no one can say for sure, I just met you, but my gut says the following. Public policy would be a mistake for sure, because it seems like everybody in the Bay Area wants to change policy. So you've got a million of these people, and it takes the average person who's in there, who's 51 now, by the time you apply, get in, and even though they say the program is 2 years, it takes many people, especially if you're older, longer. So you're now a 54-year-old or 55-year-old, new master's degree in public policy when your most recent job was accounting clerk. I'm not willing to bet that that huge amount of money and time is the best use of your money. Now, mm-hmm. a stronger argument, certainly on a rational basis, could be made for getting the master's in program management, because you have that in your background, and that could upgrade your skill set, help you navigate. On the other hand, it could also, sometimes people go to school as a way of escaping the real world. They say, you know what, I really, like you said, I have a lack of confidence, so, you know, maybe if I just hide away in school a while, I won't have to face it, because in school, all I have to do is kind of do the assignments or whatever, but it's not like in the real world where they're paying me to do X, Y, or Z. Would the goddess say that you're going for the master's in a nonprofit management is an escape or an appropriate next step?
It is appropriate, especially if it's actually worth something when I'm done. Like, as I say, like, I've been having a hard time with the job market.
Right.
And I would only want to do something like that if it was going to improve my chances when I was finished.
It will improve your chances. The question is how much. It may just be because you're on the radio, but you're hesitant in the way you speak, and that could reflect a lack of confidence or whatever. So certainly, you know, depending upon the extent to which you can improve both your skill set, but also your interviewing, your networking, the usual crap, you know, the quality of your LinkedIn profile, how much time you actually spend on the search, you know, it will improve your odds. How much not? If you're my sister, I'm a little nervous about you investing that much time and money when it's not sure how much that will benefit you, and it will be easier to go from accounting clerk to coordinator in a nonprofit program, some nonprofit program, than mm-hmm. it would be to go and get this master's and then as a new 55-year-old suddenly get to be hired as a manager again. If you're my sister, I say, take one, you know, go try to get the coordinator job using your network as much as possible, because when you're a clerk, your chances of getting a promotion are best when you use your network. But I would probably also, to keep myself from festering, I would take one course, whether it be, you know, a really practical course on Udemy or Lynda, LYNDA, which is LinkedIn's course things, or an in-person, if you're more, you know, do better in person at a community college or whatever, like UC Berkeley Extension. Take that one course, you're growing, you don't feel like you're stagnating, but you're also not a clerk forever. How does that feel to you?
I hadn't really thought of that configuration, but that sounds pretty good. I gotta say that, like, I've appreciated the job that I've had doing the accounting. It's really helpful, just trying to figure out what I should do next. But that makes sense.
And I would encourage you, I'm going to let you go off the phone, but I want to encourage you also. I want you and a trusted friend to put on a recorder. You know, your phone has something called voice memos, a voice recorder, or any kind of recording device. And start doing mock interviews now, because if you're as hesitant on the phone, you know, in job interviews or in networking as you were with me, it may not increase your chances enough of getting a job, and you've already had a tough time in the job market. So work on improving some of your fluency by doing some role-playing, and that might help. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you for calling Work with Marty Nemco. All our lines are lighted up, but as I beg you, don't wait till the last second. We're not going to get a chance to talk to all of you. I'll probably get a chance to talk to one of you. So let's, Joanne, put whoever you think you should go on the air next on the air. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. Hi, it's you. Are you there? Let's go to the next line.
Hello. Hi. How are you doing? Yeah, I did have a question about...
Wait, have you turned down your radio? Because I'm hearing an echo.
Yeah, that's much better now, hopefully.
Okay, please go ahead.
I had a question about what you thought about unions and Yeah, I've been doing some union organizing for the past several years at this, and just wanted to get your thoughts on the state of the labor movement, and having some mixed feelings about it, and I feel very passionate about it, but also just what you thought about it, and yeah.
Well, I think there's no question. This is just an opinion. I believe unions serve an important balancing function against employer rights, but I've also seen the excesses of unions where they especially, I know a lot about teaching, and that the union will defend even very incompetent teachers, and those teachers will end up hurting children for year after year after year after year. And that's makes me sad. So I've got, and there's no question that the percentage of workers who are covered under unions has declined. And my emotional reaction is sadness about that, because I'm not crazy about just treating human beings as disposable work units to be hired just for temporary projects and having a lot of power. So I think unions have a role, but they also can be very, very hurtful in many ways too. So like many things, I try to be nuanced. What's your reaction to that?
Yeah, I understand. I've heard those kind of comments, and right. It's nothing new, especially considering the state of the job market, and just we've been outside, working on trying to unionize some shops, and there's a lot of pushback on that, those kind of things. But it's different. I think a lot of times when you mention teachers, and and also, I would even say the prison guard unions is very different, and the police officers union is very different. And I would say, because they represent a different type of worker, and versus like low wage workers, which I would say like janitors or people who work in kitchens and hotels, housekeepers, people who a lot of times are immigrants and don't have.
Listen, I'm looking at the clock here. I'm going to have to interrupt you because I'm looking at the clock and the show's over. This is where all of us, any well-meaning human being, has got to be torn apart. On the one hand, the New Testament says we must care about the least among us. And we feel like, of course, how can people get super rich when there are people starving and these janitors and fast food workers? But a recent study, when they raised the minimum wage in Seattle to $15 an hour living wage, they found that huge numbers of jobs were lost because employers say, hey, now that just pushes me over the edge, I'm going to automate. It's so darn complicated. I wish there were easy answers to all these things, but there simply are not. And so in the last few seconds, I think all I want to do is offer a couple more of these tweets. Deifying, do what you love. In other words, really kind of putting on a pedestal the idea that you should do what you love. It demeans the millions of people who do unlovable work, like those janitors he was talking about. They, in my mind, may be more worthy of respect. So I don't think we realize how we criticize, when we say, you really should do what you love. What about that person who's cleaning toilets, or who's making those burgers? Those people, they're not doing lovable work. They're doing very unlovable work. They probably deserve much more of our respect than the people who are certainly our rock stars and our politicians, to tell you the truth, really, because a lot of them really do, on all sides, are not exactly the people filled with integrity. But that's it for today. That's all the time we've got for Work with Marty Nemco. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do workovers on callers, and I will talk about three common, and I'll use the word overtly, stupid workplace practices. One of them is the open workplace. The noise. It's crazy. There's study after study now that show that people are less productive and are miserable, and actually their health is worse in these open workplaces, workspaces. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.